Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Chapel Hill's Phil Manning, who writes about science topics, has written, by the way, just some great books about taking walks all across the Carolinas and the South, and about a wonderful book, Islands of Hope, about threatened and non-threatened places, what we would call nature preserves, and all of the issues that arise. But now, Phil, you're gotten interested in broader science topics, and I get an email from you every Monday with summarizing some of the science books that have caught your attention as being important. And so I wanted you to come visit with us something about what you're thinking about and what some of these books should tell us.
Well, we've got because I review so many science books, I get them from publishers all the time.
So that you get inundated with all the science books, they send them to you, so that hoping that you'll review them.
That's right.
You'll write about it, and so you do.
And so what I've done is, since I can't review them all, but I put out this newsletter called Science Book News, in which I give sort of a real quick couple of three sentences about books that look important, and people that are interested, science buffs, would be interested in reading. And so I give that, and I send it out once a week, and about three books every week. And then, in addition to that, I provide them a link to any book reviews that I've done. And it seems to be working out pretty well. We've got a pretty good circulation now.
Well, you got my attention, that's for sure.
Well, thank you. But it seems to be filling a need. Some people are very interested in these books.
You know, I don't read a lot of science books. I read a lot of books. But why are science books important?
Let me first of all tell you what other people think about it. It was really interesting to me. This is Will and Ariel Durant, in their Monumental History of Civilization, said in one of the books, I've forgotten which one now, one of the volumes, was that they said, what three books shaped the mind of modern Europe? That was the question that they sort of posed to themselves.
They would be writing in 1950, 60,
60s, somewhere in there, yeah. And it wasn't, surprisingly enough, it wasn't Shakespeare, it wasn't any philosophers, it was three books of science that they say shaped the mind of modern Europe today. And those books were the Newton's Principia, Copernicus and the heliocentric system, and Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. Those books, they said, really were the most significant books in terms of shaping
the way
Europe is.
These are humanitarian, these are historians who are in the tradition of the Western canon, which is mostly non-history books.
That's correct. They are not science writers at all. But this is what they came up with. And the more I thought about it, even if you don't want to go quite that far, the books of popular science, that is to say books that are not academic texts but are intended for the general public, are wonderful educational guides for people. I mean, they really are. You can get one on just about any topic, and when you get through reading it, you will actually know something about that topic, much more than you'll see the headlines in the paper about global warming or about genetically modified foods or about many, many other things. But most people, if they would just take the time, and it's talking a couple of hours in the afternoon, maybe 3 or 4 hours, to read one of these books about any of those topics that interest them, they would walk away actually knowing a lot about it.
Prepared to engage in enlightened cocktail party conversation rather than just what happened to be in the newspaper this morning.
Yeah, and because people have to make decisions on these things. I mean, particularly if they're associated with health or something like that. They actually have to make personal decisions. Do I buy this kind of stuff or that kind of stuff or this thing or that thing or whatever? And so it's important. I mean, it's really important. And these books provide a vehicle for learning what you need to know to do that.
I want to continue with this, but one of the things that you said a minute ago I can't get off my mind, and that is the three books that the Durants, the great multi-volume historians, said shaped Western thought. And what was, do you remember how they rationalized this, why they felt this was so important for history rather than the important, and I tell you why I'm probing on this, is that I've just had a conversation with a classicist who is so disappointed with our curriculum that doesn't emphasize Latin and Greek and all of the ancient languages and all of these canons of Western literature, because from his point of view, you can't equip a person to deal with modern life unless they're well-grounded in the literature and philosophy. and language of Western thought. And the Durants and you have taken a different, like, sort of taken me in a different direction. And would you expound on that?
Yeah, well, I can't recall exactly what their rationale was, but I can tell you a little bit about what it should have been and probably was, except I just don't remember.
Well, we won't challenge
you. But for example, Newton. I mean, before Newton, there was literally no sense of that the world, the universe, was governed by laws. There just wasn't any sense of that. I mean, what Newton did led directly to the Enlightenment. I mean,
before Newton, we thought everything was happening without rules. The sun happened to come up every day. It wasn't regularized. I mean, what was it? It's hard for us to conceive of a world like
that. It really is. And we don't know exactly what it was like. Of course, nobody that was alive today, presumably, was alive then. And so we don't know for sure. But it was more of a you drop a rock. Why does the rock fall? Well, Aristotle said it fell because the rock was like Earth and it wanted to be part of the Earth. I mean, many people, I suspect, in the pre-Newton days were like, God wants rocks to fall, so that's why rocks fall. It wasn't until Newton that came along and said, there is a reason that things happen, and I can tell you what those reasons are, and I can write them down, I can even give you the mathematics, and if you'll pay attention to what I say, I'll tell you when the sun's going to come up, when it's going to go down, where it's going to go.
What Newton introduced, I mean, introduced is not the right word, but what he brought to Western civilization was a changing notion that instead of things being in disorder, disarray, that you could come up with a scientific law or reason for any event. If you could study it long enough and hard enough, you could make these set of rules.
Yeah, that's
that
right.
Nature would follow.
That's exactly right. Voltaire was one of the first people to really pick up on this, and he just loved Newton's stuff. Of course, he had to learn it from Madame du Châtelet, who was his mistress, who was one of the most brilliant people around him. Voltaire didn't know Newton's stuff. Newton's Principia, if you look at it today, almost nobody can understand it. It's so exoteric, so difficult to read. And furthermore, it's written in Latin. But Madame du Châtelet, Voltaire's mistress, loved this stuff. She loved mathematics. She knew mathematics. She knew Latin. She translated and explained Newton to Voltaire. Voltaire then wrote a book, the title of which escapes me, but it was about, we're all Newton's disciples now, Voltaire said. And he popularized Newton's, and
people understood Voltaire, even though somebody had to hold his hand
to
make him understand.
That's right. And not only did they understand it, but he was such a fan of Newton's because Voltaire literally hated the aristocracy and the church. They were just like, you know, on his case. I don't mean he was a Christian, but he didn't like the church. He didn't like the establishment. And he didn't like the idea there were these hereditary privileges that stemmed from nothing. And here was a book that said, wait a minute, all this stuff, this superstition, you don't need that anymore. The world is explainable and understandable. All you got to do is be smart. And you can do that. So he loved this stuff, and he popularized Newton, and it literally started the Enlightenment. Almost everybody agrees with that. Mm-hmm. And to go one step further back to Copernicus. Copernicus, of course, was the guy who came up with the heliocentric system, which means that the Earth revolves around the sun. It doesn't seem like much to us today.
It sure doesn't,
it made a big
heresy.
It was heresy, but it was also a big deal because the Earth was the center of the universe. Well, now we find out from Copernicus, well, actually it's not. The center of the universe, according to him, was the sun. Of course, now we know the sun's not the center of the universe. Every step we find out how more insignificant we and our planet are in the universe. But Copernicus took the first step. He said, no, the Earth is not the center of the universe. The sun is. And the Earth revolves around the sun. A big, big, big step forward, and probably the beginning of the scientific revolution. The last guy, Charles Darwin, of course, everybody, I presume, knows about Darwin and his theories of evolution, which enormously revised the way people thought about thought about religion, how people thought about the world is and how their relationship to that world. And as you well know, even today, people are still arguing about Darwin. There have been a number of books out recently about by scientists arguing against evolution, for evolution, for God and evolution, blah, blah, blah. All of these different possibilities. They're all being still being fought out today. This is 150 years after Darwin.
In terms of the scientific method, though, what did Darwin add to this revolution that you say was brought about by Newton's?
Now, he just followed the scientific method. Newton sort of invented it, but Darwin was a follower, not so much of Newton, but of the scientific method, and a very great, what they call synthesizer, putting together odd facts from all over the world into a single cohesive theory, probably the most universal theory in the world.
So that those who'd gotten used to the Newton's explanation of the law of gravity, which doesn't challenge anything too much. When you apply that scientific method and use the best human intelligence to figure out where life and plants and all of these things came, and you come up with the idea that that man is the product of an evolutionary progress rather perhaps than an instantaneous kind of creation as religious people had thought.
Right.
That it wasn't the method, it was the results of the method that made it so that makes it so controversial.
Yeah, it was really interesting. One of the recent books that I looked at was a book by...
I'll tell you what, Phil Manning, let's take a break and then we'll come back and talk. We're going to talk some more about Darwin?
Sure.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Phil Manning's talking to me about some of the science books that he would recommend to us, and he and I will be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Chapel Hill's own Phil Manning, who is a popular reviewer of science books for the Raleigh News and Observer and newspapers across the country, and has recently begun a science newsletter that he's delivering by email to selected people, including me, and I guess, Phil, including anybody who'd like to sign up.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the best way to sign up?
You can go to my website, www.scibooks.org, and it's got my email. They just email me with, say, subscribe, and you're on.
Great. Okay, and we'll, when we get this up on our link up on the web, we'll have that link up, but it's www.scibooks.org.
Right.
We're talking about Charles Darwin and the impact of Darwin's thinking, and you mentioned that there might be a new book or two about Darwin.
There is. The one that I reviewed, this was for the San Francisco paper, is called The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, An Intimate Portrait of Charles Darwin and His Making of the Theory of Evolution. It's by a really well-known science writer named David Quammen, who has been writing... who wrote for Outside Magazine for a long time, has won numerous awards, and is quite a good writer. Quammen put his finger on some things in this sort of a biography. It's mostly about how Darwin developed. It begins with as he arrives back in England from his voyage.
From the Beagle voyage.
So he takes from that point on. But he puts his finger on this conflict that between religion and evolution very well. And he said, first of all, there's nothing about evolution that says it can't be God or anything like that. There's nothing in there about that. What it does say, though, what it challenges, according to David Quammen, is the supposed godliness of man. Men are descended from the same, not just from apes, but from bacteria, from everything. All life began with one cell at the beginning on the earth, and it expanded, and we're all related to each other. There is no difference between us, a pig and
a
pepper plant.
I'm interrupting you, but this is so rich. There's just lots to talk about. But when Darwin got off the Beagle at the end of his voyage, had he already come to all of these conclusions? I mean, his first book, talking about the voyage, dealt with his observations and all of this without so much of the conclusions, but had he already reached these conclusions?
No, but he reached them pretty shortly thereafter. I think it was in 1838. 21 years later, he finally got around to publishing them. And so it was a little slow, but he was very, very careful man, and he knew. He knew what he was getting into.
So he was reluctant to publish, and this reminds me of the story about Galileo. He's reluctant to publish what he felt was true because he was going to disturb people? Is this what was operating in Darwin?
For two reasons with Darwin, I think. One was he's a precautious man by nature. He wanted to be sure he's right. But number two, he knew what was going to happen. He knew there was going to be a public outcry about it, and he didn't like that. I mean, he was a guy who wanted to he didn't want to disturb the status quo. He was a very highly respected and well-to-do, I might point out, member of English society. And he didn't want to disturb it. He knew he was going to, but he delayed it. And, of course, he finally got pushed into it when Wallace came up with his own theory of evolution. And Darwin said, oh, my gosh, I've been scooped. And they got together and published them or presented the paper simultaneously.
So, this is kind of an interesting story in itself, a human interest story of Darwin wishing not to disrupt society with his revolutionary views about the origins of man, but he couldn't stand for somebody else to do it, Wallace,
to come in and do it,
and on the basis of Darwin's kind of groundbreaking research and published research, somebody was going to come along. So that moved Darwin to take the risk of being, and was it as bad as he thought it was going to be?
By the time it came out, Darwin was ill. He was old. He just withdrew from the fray, to a large extent. The reaction was pretty sharp, but it wasn't nearly. It didn't last long, and it wasn't earth shattering. He could have lived through. He did live through it, and of course he had his own, you know, bulldogs that protected him and defended his theories. So, but it did shake him up, and there were some bad reviews on the origin of species.
What puzzles me, Phil, is during this time period between the end of the Voyage of the Beagle, the publication of the initial results, and then sort of the development, you know, as time marches on, science methodology matures. It was going by leaps and bounds in England at that time, wasn't it?
It was.
In other areas, so that there was more receptivity to following the scientific method to where it might lead you, even if it conflicted with some of your initial religious views.
Yeah, there was. But still, the Church of England didn't like much of the book. There were a lot of people that didn't agree. And I point out David Quammen points out why this was. It didn't really have anything to do with evolution being this godless process, which is what it is, of course, but it had to do with the fact that men are no different from any other living creature. We are the same, and therefore,
now, did Darwin,
how can we have souls?
Did Darwin assert this, or is this a logical conclusion from what Darwin said?
Logical conclusion, but Darwin was very well aware of it. I mean, he knew exactly.
Well, I mean, it depends. In this respect, it's kind of how you frame it. I mean, you say we all have an evolutionary origins, but it doesn't mean that man isn't different. I mean, man's pathway might have gone alongside, but a religious person can always argue this was part of God's plan.
And they do. That is, in fact, one argument. Of course, in another book about this, a very recent one, just out, called The Language of God by Francis Collins, the man who was the government's lead man in the deciphering the human genome. He's got a book out about this, and he said, because this question comes up over and over again, Collins is a committed Christian. Many biologists, Darwin included, were not. They were atheists. So,
now, whoa. Darwin, now, is there some controversy about this?
No.
Darwin started out religious. Is that right?
A little bit.
I thought that Darwin I thought Darwin's a member of Church of the England establishment and all of this, but you're saying he was an atheist.
He knew. I mean, you admitted it. It was not something he broadcast. It's not something he wanted everybody to know. But he
didn't go to church.
I don't know. I'm not sure whether he went to church or not, but it didn't make any difference. So his views were very straightforward.
Well, this is interesting to me, and I'm going to check, but that it puts the conflict between Darwinism and Christianity in starker relief if Darwin, unlike Collins, for instance, was defined himself as a non-believer.
Yeah. He did. There's no question about it. And most, that's true for, I hate to say it, but it's true for at least many famous biologists.
Right,
Francis Crick, for example, the developer of the structure of DNA, was not only an atheist, he was a militant atheist, as Richard Dawkins, selfish gene guy, many of them are.
All right, well, let's
Francis
take a break.
Collins is not.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk about Francis Collins, who is a committed Christian and a very good scientist who argues in favor of the compatibility. You're going to explain that to us after the break. Talking to Phil Manning, he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm talking to Phil Manning. We're talking about science books, and we've gotten into talking about the conflict as a result of talking about Charles Darwin, the conflict between what the scientific method takes you to and our religious beliefs, and whether or not it's possible to be a good scientist and a good Christian. You have one example, Dr. Collins.
Yeah, well, I think there are probably many examples.
Well, you've got one example.
But, there's no question that, at least in my own mind, that you can be a good Christian and a good scientist. The question is, how do you reconcile the two? And that's what Collins attempts to do. And his method of doing this is taking it. He started off as an atheist and became a Christian.
He was converted in pursuing the scientific method. Sometimes our notion is that it really works the other way, that you come with a set of religious beliefs unfamiliar with the scientific method, and then as you explore science, you say, these can't go together, and you lose your faith. But
that's,
this is the opposite in this case.
That's
who is
correct.
It? Tell us about this guy.
Francis Collins is a he likes to describe himself as a guitar playing, motorcycle riding, and so on and so forth. Actually, my own the little bit I've seen of him, he looks like a very reserved, down to earth, good scientist who, he, by the way, went to med school here at the University of North Carolina. And the book that I'm reading now, the book that I'm going to be reviewing called The Language of God, I'll be reviewing for Peter Zane at the News and Observer sometime in the next couple of 3 weeks. But it's a fascinating, it's an interesting book because he does, you're exactly right, DJ, he goes the opposite. Instead, he starts off as an atheist and becomes a Christian. Most of them start off as Christians and become atheists. So he's gone in the opposite
what
direction.
What is his science? What distinguishes him as a scientist?
The Human Genome Project. That was a big project. I've forgotten how many people and how many billions of dollars were involved. But it is the code. That's where the title of his book, The Language of God, by the way, was a term used by Bill Clinton when he and Tony Blair jointly announced that the human genome had been deciphered, had been completely read. I don't think it's a particularly good analogy myself, but obviously Francis Collins did.
So Francis Collins, in the midst of, you know, the genetic research, which looks like now you can explain why everybody is like why they are and why the variations develop and these genetic strands that that someone says, okay, that's God's plan, or is that where Collins comes?
I'm not sure about.
Okay,
that's not clear from the book.
What does he say? What does the book say?
His basic approach was this. It's really pretty interesting. It comes from C.S. Lewis' work on a book called, I think, Mere Christianity. And it has to do with something called the moral law. The moral law is the law that tells us what's right and what's wrong. You can't define it much better than that. One manifestation of it is altruism, to the person who would help somebody else even though they have nothing to gain from doing that. It's his belief, Collins' belief, that God gave us the moral law. That's why humans have the moral law, and only humans have the moral law, that we We know right from wrong. We don't always obey the moral law, mind you. I mean, many of us stray far from it. But we know it's there. And we many, many people do, in fact, do good for reasons that do not directly benefit them. That would appear to him, to Collins, to be the
that's his bedrock. That's his bedrock on which he builds his faith.
And that came from C.S. Lewis. And it's really interesting because there is a whole different idea of where that came from, that the moral law.
The scientific community can develop alternative explanations for this, and yeah. Collins would recognize that. What would he say to the?
That's the weakness in the book, in my opinion, which is he essentially dismisses the possibility. Although he gives a little argument, but mainly he just dismisses the possibility that this moral law could have been a product of evolution itself. That it's good. I mean, I'll give you an example. Altruistic behavior, some scientists speculate, and of course nobody knows, some scientists speculate that altruistic behavior could have a role in mate attraction. That is to say, women like nice guys because they might make good fathers, you know, and that's one possible. In other words, but there's a whole school of thought out there. It's not just that. It goes under the term sociobiology, which came about from E.O. Wilson, the Harvard evolutionary professor. But that's the weakness in his book. He doesn't give, in my opinion, the possibility of the evolutionary background of the moral law. He gives it too short a shrift. He doesn't make that argument. There's a book out. I keep mentioning book after book. But this is a book that I reviewed for the Atlanta Journal, and it's called Our Inner Ape, and it's by a man named Duval, W-A-A-L. And in this book, he studied chimpanzees forever, years, decades and decades of watching these animals. And what he has concluded is exact opposite of what Collins concluded. He concludes that these animals are capable of altruistic behavior. He's seen it. He's observed it. He's recorded. He's documented. He's published papers about it. And so he's saying that, yeah, there is such a thing as altruistic behavior, and it came right not from philosophy, not from religion. It came from the apes. And it's diametrically opposed.
That's fascinating. What is there? How would he? What observed behavior backs up this conclusion?
Well, let me give you one example. I can't document a bunch of them, but one example was this ape. I think it was in Atlanta Zoo. I'm not sure. And a bird flew into the cage. It was open, but it had glass sides, and the bird flew into the side and boom, fell to the ground. And here's this huge chimpanzee, and he runs down there and he grabs the bird real gently, and he climbs very slowly back up this sort of a fake tree they have here, and he holds the bird's wings out until the bird flutters a little bit, and then he drops the bird and the bird flies off. I mean, he could have killed the bird, he could have eaten the bird, who knows what he could have done with the bird, but what did he do? He took care of that bird. And there's many, 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 many cases of where apes are helping one another, cleaning one another's wounds, keeping each other safe from warfare, for example. A lot of examples of stuff like that, all of which is altruistic behavior, and which Duval believes is the origins of human morality.
But his argument, I'm not familiar with the book or the argument, but I'm guessing that his argument would be, because apes demonstrate similar altruistic conduct, that with humans, this is just a more refined, matured expression of the same type things that you can observe evolving that Darwin would explain it through an evolutionary explanation.
Exactly. In other words, altruism is not a gift from God, according to some people. It is a product of evolution, and you know, as all of us go through life, you know, but there's times we help other people, there's times when we jump on other people. I mean, you know, life is like that. It's a combination of, you know, push and pull. And
that's what he said. Developing it, this explanation would say, also, not only can you observe altruistic behavior in apes, but you can observe animal behavior in humans.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely right. In fact, Duvall studied two different kinds of chimpanzees. One was the regular chimpanzee, the one we're familiar with. The other is the bonobo, which is used to be called a pygmy chimpanzee. And they like night and day difference. I mean, the normal chimpanzees, the ordinary chimpanzees, man, they have a rough and tumble political system. They fight wars. They do this. They do that. The bonobos, they're all about sex. Everything is settled with sex. And so here you got two creatures that are essentially identical, and yet their cultures are
quite
different.
They hold different moral code in their little culture.
It is. It really is. And so, but yet he points out in the book, I mean, and rightfully so, that, you know, bonobos are not all nice and gentle, and chimpanzees are not all bad either. They both got some good and some bad in them. But it, this idea, this whole idea that morality is an evolved characteristic is a really interesting thing. It's becoming more and more important, I think, as people really start to think about it. But this is a challenge to people's religion, and many people just reject it out of hand because of that.
Well, for me, and in terms of it becomes real easy to rationalize any scientific discovery, in the sense that if you believe all this is in the framework of a plan or an overall creator, it's not difficult to say, well, that's consistent with a notion of with my notion of religion, because that's the way God planned for it to be, or that's the way it worked, or allowed it to work out.
Yeah, that's true.
And then you can't. It's hard for even a scientist.
I think the so-called war between science and religion is way, way overblown. I feel there's going to always be a few real hard pushers on both sides, both religion. But most people are starting to know, yeah, science and religion can coexist. They do coexist. You know, there's no real conflict. If you have to admit some things, if you're a religious person about science, you can't deny the science. And Collins is very good with that. He puts down people, the young earth creationists, he calls them, people who think the world was created 10,000 years ago and God put all these species. He says that's total nonsense. And intelligent design, he says, is an completely intellectually bankrupt movement, in his opinion. I mean, he never denies the science at all. And you can do that.
Well, let's take a quick break. I'm talking to Phil Manning. We're talking about some of the recent science books that he has read and reviewed, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Chapel Hill's Phil Manning and I are talking about science books that he's read and has been reviewing for the Raleigh News Observer and for papers across the country. I feel we've been talking a lot about evolution, which is, and that's appropriate because that's right, that's going to be on the front pages as long as you and I are alive. But there's so many other of these topics, like global warming, genetic research, genetically modified foods, stem cell research. These are scientific matters that people are worried about and writing about. Which of them's, we probably got time to talk about one of them the way we talk about. What's the leading?
Well, why not talk about the one that everybody else has already talked about, which is global warming.
Okay, well.
There's several books, in fact, four books out on global warming. That I've taken a look at, and the one that I ended up reviewing for the Raleigh paper was a book called The Weathermakers by an Australian scientist named Tim Flannery. It is the best book, I think, from a scientific point of view. Some of the others, Elizabeth Colbert's book, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, is an excellent book, but it's a slightly more anecdotal in nature. But the thing that came out to me of the Weathermakers, the global warming book, is a couple. I mean, now, of course, I presume most people, at least in Chapel Hill, have seen An Inconvenient Truth, Al Gore's movie, which is also very, very, very potent, I thought. But the one thing that Flannery does that I thought was so good was to talk about first the greenhouse effect. People don't seem to understand the greenhouse effect, but it absolutely is scientific fact. This is no question about the greenhouse effect. As you put greenhouse gases, and let's just take carbon dioxide, which is one of them, you can calculate You can calculate how much the temperature is going to rise from sunlight, because it's a simple matter that the radiation from the sun hits the earth, it becomes infrared radiation, and it's absorbed by carbon dioxide and becomes heat. There's no question, no if and buts, no nothing. It is that way.
So can you quantify, for instance, if you can calculate how much additional carbon dioxide is going into the atmosphere as a result of man's activities, whatever they might be, if you could quantify that, you could then scientifically determine the increase in temperature that's going to be caused by that? Or you just know in general it's going to make things
warmer? No, you could calculate it exactly, all other things being equal. That's the catch word, which means could it be more cloudy, which would reflect more sunlight back? Could it be this, could or that? But if everything else were equal, you would know exactly how much the temperature would go up. And it's interesting because we already know how much is, we already been measuring carbon dioxide directly for years and years and years and years and years. So we know that's going up. So we know several things. We know the greenhouse effect is we absolutely know for sure it's real. We absolutely know for sure that the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is going up. We absolutely know for sure that the temperature of the Earth is going up. Those three things we know. The only possible argument is, well, how do you know that it is, in fact, the increase in carbon dioxide that's causing the Earth's temperature to increase? Well, the reason is that it could be nothing else. That's what it amounts to. That's the only reason it could be, at least most people. That's what almost all scientists will tell you. And I certainly believe it. So the fact that global warming has happened, is happening, and is going to continue to happen, to me, is an absolute certainty.
Who are the people who argue with this? I mean, you say no science, no credible scientist. No, there's no scientist that they can put on the stand.
You can always find a guy with a PhD who will tell you what you want to hear if the price is right. I shouldn't have said that. I mean, some people, there probably are a few scientists that sincerely believe that the global warming that we're experiencing is part of some natural cycle or something like that. But they are very, very few and far between. Like anything else in science, you can't prove something is so. Proof can show up that says that something is false, but not that it's so, because the next set of data that comes along could vex you. So I would say that 99% of the scientists that are involved in this at all believe that that global warming is underway, and that the source of it is anthropogenic. That is to say, it's people throwing carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
As human beings, animals, as you have argued that we all are, we discharge carbon dioxide, and that has not been viewed as a – that's not a major – is that a major contributor? Is population increase the
no?
What is it that
it is burning machinery. Fossil fuels? And you know, burning of fossil fuels is what it is. I mean, you take a pound of coal and you're making a lot of carbon dioxide when you burn it, and it's all.
So it's fires. It's burning that creates it. What if we burn wood? Does that create
same thing?
Same
yeah.
Thing?
It's not
fossil fuels. It's burning organic matter of some kind, or
anything with carbon in it that burns. And burning means it combines with oxygen, and so you got CO2. And so if you burn anything, you create CO2. But the difference, really, between the wood is, of course, when you form the wood, you're taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere through photosynthesis to form the wood. But coal, all this happened millions and millions of years ago, and so now you're in effect taking. You're releasing what sunlight created millions of years ago, and it was just a lot more carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere than ever has in the history of the world, and this goes up every year. So the concentration of carbon dioxide is going up.
So of the books that you've read, which do you recommend?
I would strongly recommend anybody. I loved. The Gore movie, An Inconvenient Truth. I thought that was very good. The Weathermakers by Tim Flannery is a wonderful book.
Tim Flannery's book, Weathermakers, is your recommended book. You have no book to recommend that takes the other side.
None. I don't believe there. No, there is nobody. There is no book about that. And I don't, certainly nothing in the last 3 or 4 years.
But what we like to have in the, I mean, what we need in arguments of every variety is somebody taking the other side. And when somebody tells me there's no other side, it just there's got to be another side somewhere.
Well, there is another side. In fact, there's one guy at MIT who says, well, yeah, we got global warming and it's happening, but you can't tell me for sure
that it's
coming from human sources, from burning fossil fuels. And you can't tell him for sure, but you can tell him almost for sure.
Well, there's another law of science that we can't avoid, and that is the one of time. We haven't gotten started, but we've run out of time. Phil Manning, I hope that you'll come back and continue this conversation about the scientific issues that are raised in the science books that you review for the News Observer and for other newspapers. Please come back.
Thank you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. I'll be back same time tomorrow.